David took up this lament concerning Saul and his son Jonathan, and he ordered that the people of Judah be taught this lament of the bow. This is just after Saul and Jonathan had died. A gazelle lies slain on your heights, Israel. How the mighty have fallen. Tell it not in Gath, proclaim it not in the streets of Ashkelon, lest the daughters of the Philistines be glad. Mountains of Gilboa, may you have neither dew nor rain, may no showers fall on your terraced fields, for there the shield of the mighty was despised, the shield of Saul, no longer rubbed with oil. From the blood of the slain, from the flesh of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan did not turn back, the sword of Saul did not return unsatisfied. Saul and Jonathan, in life they were loved and admired, and in death they were not parted. They were swifter than eagles, they were stronger than lions. Daughters of Israel, weep for Saul, who clothed you in scarlet and finery, who adorned your garments with ornaments of gold. How the mighty have fallen in battle. Jonathan lies slain on your heights. I grieve for you, Jonathan, my brother. You were very dear to me. Your love for me was very wonderful, more wonderful than that of women. How the mighty have fallen, their weapons abandoned and useless. Now this week, the contest for the next Conservative Prime Minister began. After the first round, as you will have noticed, Boris Johnson was way out in front, but he has been criticised for his unwillingness to face the scrutiny of a debate with other contenders. He's going to do the BBC on Tuesday, I think, but he's not prepared to do Channel 4 tonight. In the end, a tiny percentage of largely white-skinned, middle-class southerners will make the decision about who will be the next Prime Minister. I like this picture, if you'd just like to put it up for me. The world is being run by some very interesting people. The press always has fun with images of Boris and Donald Trump, don't they? But the reason I say all this is I wonder what he's really like, Boris Johnson. I wonder what he's really like. Do you have any idea? I think some of you may know Boris slightly better than the rest of us, but what's he really like? All right, enough of that picture, thank you. I don't know if you remember Lance Armstrong. Lance Armstrong was a quite extraordinary athlete. He was a marathon runner, he was a triathlete, very successful in sport, and eventually became a professional cyclist. During the 1990s, he had won several races, but none of the big races at that point. During the 1990s, he was diagnosed with testicular cancer. It spread from there to his brain and his lungs and looked like it might be terminal. He was given surgery, he was given chemotherapy, and it led to a complete cure. And as a result, he started a charity to support people with that particular form of cancer. By 1998, he was back on his bike. And then, amazingly, he won the next seven Tour de France's. From 1999 to 2005, he won it. It was unprecedented, unheard of, that one single rider could achieve all of that. He wrote an autobiography about his story, recovery from cancer, and how he became such an amazing winner, and it became a bestseller. Then it transpired in about 2011-12 that he and his team had the most sophisticated cheating system, using not only performance-enhancing drugs, but storing his own blood for transfusion during long races like the Tour de France, so that he would have fresh blood. And it was completely undetectable because it was his own blood. He and his team had managed to go undetected through that long streak of winning the Tour, because the technology wasn't out there. But eventually, as a result of the pursuit of one particular journalist who had an idea what was going on, eventually his colleagues owned up to it and testified to their part in it and effectively testified against him. And eventually the truth came out. His reputation from being a star was in complete tatters. To be fair to him, he was continuing to raise money for cancer research. And when he appeared on Oprah Winfrey in 2013, he was agonizingly honest. He has 5 children. I wonder what they make of him. See, most of us want to project a good image of ourselves, don't we? Young people use Photoshop a lot from what I can make out, and they put images of themselves up on Snapchat and Instagram. And you look at these pictures and think, what fantastic skin they've got. It's a trick. It's a trick that we all do because we want to put a good impression of ourselves. We don't want people to see us as we really are. I've yet to work out how Photoshop can make bald-headedness look good. But there we are. Still working on it. We follow the lives of other people with relish. We like to look at their mistakes and their failings, and the stuff of tomorrow's conversation comes out of all that stuff. You may be watching Love Island at the moment, and you'll be passing judgment on these pretty people that they've served up for us in this series. And outside of Love Island, you have the failings of rap stars, actors, high-profile sports people. They're all laid bare for our entertainment, all the mistakes that they have made. And then we crave more information. What are the royals really like? They're so quiet, aren't they? Could it be true that Charles is actually nicer than his mother? I've heard that rumour. Why didn't Meghan attend the banquet with Donald Trump? You know, was there something going on there? And what's Donald Trump really like? Are we being fed fake news by our own media? Well, today, God calls us to step away from looking at other people and give thought to the kind of people we want to become. He invites us to take a long, hard look at ourselves before we go back to passing judgment on other people, if at all. And I would suggest that when you have stood honestly before God's scrutiny, you will be kinder in your judgment of other people. David's words at the news of Saul's death are particularly striking. How the mighty have fallen. Saul, as you know, was no pillar of virtue. God's anointing on Saul had been removed many years before, and then David had emerged, the popular successor to Saul. And Saul had been driven by jealousy and rage. And we have charted over these last few weeks his pursuit of David in his doomed yet relentless quest to hang on to the throne. And David, at that moment in time when he heard the news of Saul's demise, had every right to be dismissive, to rejoice in his death, to wallow in his own vindication. But instead, David is magnanimous. There is something surprisingly honest and genuine about his grief. Whatever his own personal experience of Saul, this was a moment of tragedy and loss for the nation. And so he embraced the role of a statesman and spoke with eloquence of Saul and Jonathan. In life they were loved and admired, and in death they were not parted. They were swifter than eagles, they were stronger than lions. Daughters of Israel, weep for Saul, who clothed you in scarlet and finery, who adorned your garments with ornaments of gold. How the mighty have fallen in battle. How generous is David in these moments. I don't know how many of you watched the film Invictus. It's a film about the 1993 Rugby World Cup, which South Africa surprisingly won. They had a run of very bad form. But it kind of coincided with the release of Nelson Mandela and the emergence of Nelson Mandela as the nation's leader. And he got together with the captain of the South African team and said to him, I think it's important that South Africa win this World Cup. He was on a quest to actually build a new South Africa. But then a group of people, a delegation, came to him and said, we want to change the South African colours. These have always been associated with the old South Africa, with apartheid. We need to change the colours to celebrate the new South Africa. And Nelson Mandela courageously looked at these people in the face and said, this is not the time for some kind of petty revenge. We have the opportunity to build a new South Africa. We have the opportunity to return evil with good. There's something about getting older where you are able to see a much bigger picture in life. We know only too well the frailty of human nature around us, even our own human nature. And so, in the end, hopefully, we learn to speak generously, to applaud the good in others and overlook the bad in them. Before we dismiss the celebrities, we need to pause to reflect on our own frailties. And so this is a briefer sermon this morning, and I ask you the question, just simply this. What is it that you want to become? Fathers and mothers, you want to move beyond the selfish appetites of youth and become agents of transformation? Do you want to invest in your children's futures? And all of you here, do you want to become spectators of other people's misfortunes or support workers helping to put their lives and reputations back together again? We're Baptists here, and the Baptists emerged in England in the 1600s, not that long ago, really. And they were at a point a particularly persecuted minority around the time of Charles II. And then gradually life became a bit easier for them. But they used to meet together at certain times. And when a new minister was appointed to a church, they'd meet together then. And the services, believe it or not, would last 5 hours. They really went on. They had hymns that had about 30 verses, and they sung the lot. And on one of these occasions down in southeast Kent, in Athorne, somebody minuted the whole service. It was 5 hours long, but they actually timed everything. They didn't have watches back in those days, but must have been a clock looking around somewhere. And they sort of said the first hymn took 15 minutes. And then there was a charge to the minister, and that took an hour. And then there was a charge to the church, and that took an hour. Then there was another hymn, and that took another 20 minutes, and so on. And the prayer went on and on. And there was loads and loads of stuff, and it went on for 5 hours. But what I found out was quite interesting. It was that the young people were taken outside. This is like, when I say the young people, I'm talking about sort of late teens, early 20s. And they met up with other young people from other Baptist churches. Because the view was, you really mustn't marry a Catholic and you mustn't marry somebody from the Church of England. You have to marry somebody who's a Baptist. So it's a bit of a matchmaking thing that went on. And it's kind of survived over the years. And one of the funny things about finding somebody else is that people will ask the question, are you a Christian? And the person will say, yes. In fact, I know a couple. The guy did actually become a Christian in the end, but his wife-to-be said to him on one occasion, said, I can't go out with you unless you're a Christian. He said, oh, yeah, I am a Christian. And she said, oh, that's all right then. And so they went out. And it's such a funny kind of superficial question, isn't it? Are you a Christian? You know, what kind of Christian are you? What does that mean exactly? And they sort of did a similar thing back then. You know, are you a Baptist? Oh, that's okay then. That's great. Whereas really the question we need to ask is, what kind of person do you want to become? Those are the kind of deeper questions. What's your goal in life? What's your purpose in life? What do you want to achieve? What sort of person do you want to become? And one of the marks of Christianity is that you stop pointing the finger at other people and start putting your arm around them. That's the message of this particular chapter, I think. When Jesus began his ministry and he spoke those famous words that God so loved the world that he sent his only son, he followed them in John 3:17 with these words, "For God did not send his son into the world to condemn the world, but to save the world." Jesus was not in the business of putting people down, but in picking people up. So may we, like David, become statesmen and stateswomen. May we become magnanimous, generous people. And may the four of you being baptized today grow into people who will be givers and not takers, helpers and not critics. For we follow in the footsteps of the one who gave everything for us. May we give everything for him. Okay,